Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet him, greet him, treat him, and street him. Today's date is April 26, 2017, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is Somebody's Watching Me, Cardiac Monitoring for Chest Pain. And I have not one, but two great guest skeptics. Yes, I have Dr. Ryan Tam and Anthony Roberts, and they are chief residents from the Royal College Emergency Medicine Program at McGill University. Now, Ryan, he has academic interests including quality improvement, ultrasound, and simulation. He's involved with a startup FOMED site called EM Bites, focused on providing point-of-care resources. Welcome to the SGEM, Ryan.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. And the other guest skeptic is the other chief resident, Anthony Roberts. His academic interests include resuscitation, medical education, research, ultrasound, and medical informatics. Welcome to the SGEM, Anthony.
Hi, Ken. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for coming to Montreal.
Thanks for bringing that smooth voice with you. You are made for podcasting. All right. Now, you may or may not know that we are recording this live as part of a journal club. So we have an audience of McGill University residents. Now, it is a pleasure to be back at this great institution. I was here in October of 2014, where I recorded SGEM number 50, the first SGEM Journal Club. And it's an honor to be back here again to do another SGEM Journal Club. And it was Dr. William Osler who is credited for starting the first formal journal club at McGill University in 1875. And you know what the original purpose was? It was for the purchase and distribution of periodicals to which he could ill afford to subscribe. So it sounds like he was ahead of his time and already doing the FOMED. Gentlemen, let's remind everybody about the five rules. How many rules are there?
There are five rules, Ken.
Thank you. There are five rules to journal club. So let's run through those journal club rules. What's the first rule?
Well, rule one, you must talk or tweet about SGEMJC.
Yeah, so if you're going to have a journal club, share it with the world. Share it with the globe. Make it FOMED. Talk about it. Tweet about it. What's the second rule?
The EBM answer is, it all depends.
Yes, the evidence-based medicine answer to any question I learned from my EBM mentor, Dr. Andrew Worcester out of McMaster University. That answer is, it all depends. And the third rule?
Don't panic. Even your faculty is not sure of some of the answers.
That's right. They just had a head start. They had multiple year head start, but they may not be any smarter than you. They just had a longer clinical experience. So, of course, be skeptical and respectful. All right, number four.
It's all about the methods.
Oh, yes, I am a bit of a nerd. And when I read a paper, one of the first things I go to is the methods, because it all comes down to the methods. And what's the fifth and final rule?
Be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on SGEMJC.
That's right. So remember to always be skeptical of anything you learn or hear, especially on the SGEM. So we're going to do a case presentation. Who's got the case?
I got the case, Ken. So you're working on a busy shift with a bed-blocked emergency department. A 52-year-old gentleman known for coronary artery disease and hypertension presents with slightly suspicious chest pain. He is triaged and put in your monitored area. When you see him, he describes exertional retrosternal chest pain, which is now resolved. Initial EKG shows non-specific T-wave changes. A two-hour troponin drawn on arrival is negative, with repeats pending. Nurses are asking for more monitor beds, pressuring you to wonder whether it's safe to take their patients off monitors while he waits for his results.
All right, audience. Do you think that this is a reasonable case? Do you see patients like this?
Yeah.
Very, very common presentation to a Canadian emergency department. All right, let's get some background information to frame the discussion that we're going to have when we critically appraise the paper.
So currently, the patients that come in with chest pain in Canada are triaged using the Canadian Triage and Acuity Scale, and to either require frequent reassessment and cardiac monitoring or not. And we use the cardiac monitoring to be able to identify and capture these malignant ischemic arrhythmias and reperfusion arrhythmias. So in 2004, the AHA guidelines suggested that cardiac monitoring is important for all those people for about 24 hours after they're symptom-free. And a tool was derived in 2007 that suggested 100% sensitivity that patients with chest pain and a normal ECG can be placed in a non-monitored bed without the risk of arrhythmias.
Okay, so what's the clinical question that we're going to try to answer on today's podcast?
So do all patients presenting to the emergency department with chest pain need to be placed on a cardiac monitor, or can some of them be safely removed?
What reference do we have to answer the question?
So it's an article by Syed et al. It's the prospective validation of a clinical decision rule to identify patients presenting to the emergency department with chest pain who can safely be removed from cardiac monitoring. It appeared in the CMAJ in January 2017.
Ooh, we're talking about knowledge translation, cutting that KT window down from over 10 years to less than 1 year. And in this case, this podcast will be published in April, so we're talking about 4 months. Let's run through the PICO, the population, the intervention, the comparison, and the outcome. What was the population in this study?
So the population was adult patients presenting to the emergency department with chest pain, and these included pains going to the neck, shoulder, back, or abdominal pains that were all suspicious for cardiac cause. And they were also, of course, placed on cardiac monitor.
Who did they exclude?
They excluded patients who had a cardiac arrest before arrival at the hospital or showed a STEMI on their first ECG.
And what was their intervention?
So they used the Ottawa chest pain cardiac monitoring rule, where patients with chest pain can be removed from cardiac monitoring if the initial physician assessed the following: that the patient is currently chest pain free and the ECG was normal without any ischemic changes or no infarction changes, no bundle branch block, prolonged QRS, QT or PR intervals. They didn't have any left ventricle hypertrophy, no arrhythmias, or they were not having any pace rhythms.
So just to emphasize that Ottawa chest pain cardiac monitoring rule, the patient had to be currently chest pain free and the ECG had to be normal or have non-specific changes. And so what did they compare it to?
There was no comparison group.
All right, what was their primary outcome?
The primary outcome was arrhythmias requiring intervention within 8 hours of emergency department arrival.
And their secondary outcome?
Diagnostic characteristics of the Ottawa CPCM rule.
So that's the chest pain cardiac monitoring rule. So the author's conclusions were, quote, "We successfully validated the decision rule for safe removal of a large subset of patients with chest pain from cardiac monitoring after initial evaluation in the emergency department. Implementation of this simple yet highly sensitive rule will allow for improved use of healthcare resources." Well, for clinical decision tools, and you guys will note that I use the word tool, not rule, because what are rules meant to be?
Broken.
That's right. Rules are meant to be broken. And so we used a clinical decision tool or instrument to guide our care. And in this case, there's 9 things that we go through to check the validity or have threats to the validity of the study. And so we'll start with question number 1. The study population included or focused on those in the emergency department?
Absolutely. The study was conducted in 2 tertiary Canadian emergency departments.
Question 2. The patients were representative of those with the problem?
Well, and it appears so. In Table 1, the characters show that it represents a reasonable standard population that we'll see in the emergency department with chest pain.
Question 3, all important predictive variables and outcomes were explicitly specified.
Yes, as this was a validation study of a previously derived decision rule, the predictor and outcome variables were well defined.
Number 4, is this a prospective multi-centered study, including a broad spectrum of patients and clinicians, a level 2 study?
Yes. However, the study is validating a rule that was derived previously at the same institution.
Okay, question 5. Clinicians interpret individual predictor variables and score the clinical decision rule reliably and accurately?
No, the ECGs were not read by the treating emergency physicians.
Question 6. This is an impact analysis of a previously validated clinical decision tool.
Actually, no, this is the validation study.
Okay, for level 1 studies, an impact on clinicians' behavior and patient-centric outcomes is reported?
The study didn't look at patient-centered outcomes, nor did it look at how it would affect physicians' practices.
So this wasn't a level 1 study on the impact of clinical behavior and clinical-centric outcomes. Question number 8. The follow-up was sufficiently long enough and complete?
Well, yes, the 24-hour review of visitations and a 30-day follow-up, that's reasonable timeframes for a study conducted in the emergency department.
And the 9th and final question, the effect size, was it large enough and precise enough to be clinically significant?
The effect size was large. Applying the rule could have resulted in 36% of patients being safely removed from cardiac monitors. However, given the small event rate, there were also wide confidence intervals.
All right, well, why don't we go through some of those key results? And I'll start it off. Almost 71% of patients presenting to the emergency department were put on monitors and enrolled in this study. The mean age was 64 years, with 56% being male and 9% ultimately being admitted to hospital. But what was the primary outcome?
The primary outcome was that 2% were identified as having clinically important arrhythmias, and the Ottawa CPCM rule detected all 15 of those patients.
All right, and how about the secondary outcomes?
The Ottawa CPCM rule had the following test characteristics: a sensitivity of 100% with a 95% confidence interval of 78.2 to 100%, as well as a specificity of 36.4% with a 95% confidence interval of 33% to 39.6%.
And we'll go through some of those confidence intervals in the Talk Nerdy section. But how about the application of the Ottawa chest pain cardiac monitoring rule? What would happen if you used it?
If we used the Ottawa CPCM rule, it would have allowed up to 36% of patients to be safely removed from cardiac monitoring.
Well, it's time to talk a little nerdy. And you know what? We have an extra special element here for the S-Gemmers, but I'm not going to reveal it. Anthony, I'm going to give it to you to do the big reveal.
All right. So we've actually been lucky enough to get one of the authors of the article to be on the show with us, Dr. Venk. I'll let him introduce himself because he's got quite an interesting story.
This is Venkatesh Thiruganasambandamurthy. I'm one of the emergency physicians at the Ottawa Hospital. I'm an assistant professor at the University of Ottawa and a scientist with the Ottawa Hospital Research Institute. My area of interest is cardiovascular emergencies, and I do research primarily on syncope and a little bit on chest pain.
And we talked earlier before we started recording, and you gave us permission to call you Venk. So I appreciate that, Venk, and I appreciate you coming on the S-Gem to discuss your research.
Thank you. It is a pleasure and a privilege to be on S-Gem.
Well, that Ottawa group that you're involved with, you guys put out a ton, and I mean a ton, of great research on clinical decision instruments. So it's great to have you on the program, and we're going to go through 5 issues to better understand your research. And I'm going to ask Anthony to start us off with the first issue that we wanted to go through.
All right, here goes. So there was a small number of patients who had the outcome of interest, which were the arrhythmias in these patients. So this causes a few concerns. So the first one, the wide confidence interval around the point of estimate for sensitivity brings it all the way down to 78.2%. So potentially missing 27.8% of true positives.
That's a good question. So we thought about it long and hard. And as you may notice that the derivation phase was done about 10 years ago, and there was quite a bit of lull time because there was no funding that was available for the validation phase. We were doing a troponin study, and this is a sub-project within our troponin study, in order to identify NSTEMI patients quickly and as well as quick rollout of NSTEMI. As part of this project, we validated this Ottawa chest pain cardiac monitoring rule, and we had to recruit about close to 796 patients in order to validate the study. We would need a large number of patients given the arrhythmia rate of 1 to 2%, like of the order of close to 5,000 patients if we want the confidence intervals to be really small. I agree that it is one of the drawbacks of the study, but at the same time, it does not mean that, like, you know, at the extreme level, it will probably miss about 22% of patients or 21% of patients. But we don't think so it will be true. If you have a large number of patients, we think that the sensitivity will be closer towards 100%, somewhere between like 99 to 100%. We agree the small numbers, it is because of funding, but we wanted to just validate it and say that it is 100% sensitive as a point estimate, and the confidence interval is a measure of the small numbers. We don't believe that it will be towards the lower end of the confidence interval. It will be more towards the upper end of the confidence interval if validated. We are in the process of implementing it across various sites and hopefully validating it at the same time with a larger number of patients across the country.
This actually leads me to my next point. The negative predictive value looks great at 100%, but this does depend on the prevalence, as you know. So any prediction rule or Norval would look good if only 1.9% of patients have arrhythmias.
It is true. The negative predictive value is an estimate of the prevalence, but the prevalence of arrhythmias is really low. We cannot do anything about it. So if you were not monitoring all the patients, you could argue that you'll miss only 2% of patients, so the answer is 98%. But I think the more practical or pragmatic way of looking at it is that we are, none of the emergency physicians are going to say, okay, we are not going to monitor all of them and put all of them in a walk-in area, and that's the way that we are going to treat. It's just the opposite. That's how we are tuned to be as. We are just going to be monitoring all patients until otherwise we are absolutely sure that there is no arrhythmia is going to happen. By this, what we are saying is that the prevalence is low, and even among these patients with a low prevalence, using this tool, you can identify these patients who really need monitoring. Yes, the confidence intervals are high, but with 100% sensitivity, we can even tease out these low-risk patients into two categories as somebody who's at a higher risk and somebody who's at a lower risk, thereby have your monitored beds available to other patients who dire need it than these low-risk chest pain patients.
And that's very true. At our institution, there's a lot of patients that would benefit from these rooms with monitoring.
So I want to add one more thing to my previous point is that, if you just look at the study itself, in our institution, we have 71% of all patients presenting with chest pain who are being monitored, despite being lower risk. So it is probably going to be somewhere about 50 to 80% of patients across the country who are getting monitored. If we want to have our monitored beds available for other patients, and if you're uncomfortable with it, at least you have this tool, and if the tool is negative and it identifies as low risk, you can be confident of removing these patients out of monitored beds so that you can have for your septic patients and other unstable patients.
That makes sense. I mean, these tools are to aid your clinical judgment.
All right, we're going to move on to question number 2, and that's about consecutive patients. These were not consecutive patients. And in fact, you put in the manuscript there, quote, a small portion of eligible patients, 121 of 1,246 patients, 9.7%, were not enrolled because the emergency physicians were busy and did not complete the study form, end of quote. And I get that. I work in a busy emergency department at times, and you can get very busy. But this introduces a potential of 1 in 10 selection bias. And all the physician had to do to not enroll a patient was to go, you know what, I'm just too busy to enroll this one. And this may have been conscious, but it may have been unconsciously done as well. So do you think that this possible selection bias impacted your results?
I do not think that this would impact the results. If you just look at most of the prospective cohort studies, they have an enrollment rate of about 70%. Our syncope studies have got 70%, 75% enrollment rate. And for this, and 90% looks really good. That's number one. Number two is that, as I mentioned before, this is a subset of a troponin study. So for the troponin study, they really needed to collect what the presenting symptom was and when did the chest pain start. Was the patient a reliable historian? What kind of medications they were taking? And we collected data during their ED visit, all the vital signs and whether they were monitored in the emergency department. Did they suffer any arrhythmias in the emergency department? Did they come back within 30 days? So we assessed 30-day outcomes for these patients. Did they have any kind of ICD pacemaker placements, or did they end up having an NSTEMI? So though this is a sub-study and did not require much input from the physician, because they had to complete the troponin study form, and the troponin study form is a half a page form, and it was for all patients for whom they suspected an NSTEMI and who presented with chest pain. Given the volume of chest pain patients, and sometimes in the resuscitation area, things can be really busy. Sometimes they did not complete the form. So 10% of them did not complete the form. But given the small number, which is 10%, I don't think so it is going to affect, though you can argue that 1 in 10 patients were not enrolled in the study. As a corollary to that, we also looked at patients who are not monitored, which is 300 patients, which is about like close to 30% of patients were not monitored, and those patients also did not suffer any arrhythmias. So we agree that it is one of the limitations of the study that 10% did not enroll, but given in the context that this is an emergency department study and a prospective study and a physician has to complete the form, and it's an emergency physician who's very busy, we think that the impact of these non-enrolled patients in the results of the study will be very minimal, and we have no reason to believe that it is a threat to the validity of the study.
All right, so this leads me to my next question about the ECG interpretation. It is my understanding that in the study, the investigators were the one analyzing the ECGs and classifying them, but the treating emergency department doctor did not interpret the ECGs. So how could we apply this to the practicing frontline physicians?
I again agree that ideally we would have wanted the emergency physician to interpret it, but as I alluded to, the study was done as a sub-study of another study, which required a one-page ECG form to be completed, whether it's a sinus rhythm, non-sinus rhythm, did they see any old ischemic changes, new ischemic changes, old infarction, like pace rhythm, was there any bundle branch blocks? So there was a complete form that needed to be completed as part of the original study. A subset of the data was looking at whether the ECG was normal or whether there were non-specific changes, and the rest of the abnormalities in the form of old ischemia, infarction, were all clubbed together as abnormal ECG. Again, we felt that in order to balance between a good enrollment so that less number of patients are missed versus a complete data collection through a practically approaching the emergency physicians to complete these forms, we thought that it will be better that if they collect the information that is absolutely necessary that is from the patient in the form of confirmation that the patient is actually suffering chest pain and they're eligible to be included in the study. And in order to balance better recruitment strategy, so we had the ECGs to be reviewed by the investigators. But given the simplicity of the ECG criteria, it's either normal or non-specific or everything else is clubbed as abnormal. So we thought that it will be easy to implement it and as well as easy for understanding. I can understand if you say that, can we diagnose old ischemia? And then what is the inter-rater reliability of that? Like, you know, it will be probably a little bit less. Or how about diagnosing left anterior fascicular block? It will be probably less inter-rater reliability between physicians. But given the simplicity of criteria, we think that if practically emergency physicians were to apply this and categorize them as normal, non-specific, or abnormal, it should be fairly easy to do it.
Well, I think, Venk, this is just another example of the trade-off that sometimes has to be made, and also highlights just how difficult and challenging it can be to successfully complete a research project like you've done. So congratulations. The fourth issue, though, that I wanted to bring up was an issue about time and external validity. And you hinted about this, actually, in your very first response. You say 90% of emergency physicians would forego cardiac monitoring of chest pain patients if an appropriate low-risk subset could be identified. And so I pulled that reference that you made in the manuscript. And this was a study of about 200 residents and doctors from Canada from a decade ago. Do you think the attitudes in Canada would be the same now?
I think so, if at all more, because we are becoming less and less adverse event outcome tolerant as emergency physicians. Like, you know, I think probably a decade ago, we probably said, like, you know, okay, more than 95 is good. We are now approaching, like, we want to be 99% accurate. We want to be 100% accurate. And I also see in the triage process now, like, more and more patients are being triaged to a monitored area, and they want close monitoring versus less years ago. There used to be, like, you know, many of these patients were monitored, were assigned to a walk-in area. And then if we found abnormal, then we access the monitored beds. More monitored beds are now available as we are expanding more emergency visits. So I think the statistic is probably true that most emergency physicians will still believe. Unfortunately, we also alluded to in the manuscript is that there has not been much research done in this area of cardiac monitoring, both in the emergency and in the inpatient setting. In the inpatient setting, there is pretty much like less amount of research. Every patient who is admitted with chest pain is admitted to a monitored area. And since there is no monitored beds, like, no, they are sitting down in emerge admitted. So I do not think that both the attitudes and as well as the way in which it practice, if at all anything, has gotten more conservative than the other way.
What about other healthcare systems? They have different environments, different medical legal issues, different patient expectations. So what do you think the external validity of these respondents from 10 years ago in Canada, how would that relate to emergency doctors in the United States, Australia, and the UK?
So I can only make some corollaries to the syncope area where I am a lot more involved and as well as have an idea about how the other systems function. We are a lot more conservative in hospitalizations and monitoring of patients than the other systems. The other extreme is United States. They probably monitor almost 100% of all chest pain patients, and they have chest pain units. They are going to put them in the chest pain units for 2 or 3 days and do all their testing before they are discharged home. Australia, United Kingdom, and Europe have a higher monitoring rates and higher hospitalization rates than Canada. Of the Western world, we do, I think, less monitoring of patients in the ED and less hospitalizations, both for monitoring and a chest pain, I believe. Because you can just see that the admission rate in our cohort is like 8.9%, so which is a lot lesser than other countries. So I think we are conservative, and that speaks to the fact that more physicians, even more, they want it to be less conservative, like not have continuous monitoring of these chest pain patients. That's, I think, is the world view, and as well as what is happening in Canada.
Well, the SGEM has a global audience, and in fact, it's translated into 4 other languages. So I just wanted to make sure that people remember that when it comes to evidence-based medicine questions, the answer is, it all depends. And so what might apply to our medical, legal, and practice environment may not have external validity to places like the United States, Europe, and Australia. But I wanted to follow up with one other issue about time, and that was the fact that the derivation study was published in 2007, so that's 10 years ago. But that 2007 study was based on data collected 17 years ago. And I think, again, you said in your first response to our first question that it had something to do with funding for this long delay.
Yeah, so I was not an author in the derivation phase. It was Dr. Matthew Gatien and Dr. Jeff Perry who did it. Once again, it was a subset of another study where they were looking at biomarkers in chest pain patients. So after that, there has been nobody who has picked up this project in the form of validating it. And we are doing the ED troponin study, and as we are establishing a Canadian chest pain consortium in place in order to improve care of chest pain patients, we use this cohort of patients in order to validate this. But looking at the way that clinicians practice, chest pain patients present the same way. The workup of patients in the form of assigning them to a monitored bed continues to be the same. 70% is pretty high number of patients who are getting monitored, given the fact that it's only like 1% to 2% will have arrhythmias. We are keeping them for seated troponins, though the time we are keeping them might be different at the current time. We did compare, when we put in the study protocol, we did compare the old troponins that we used to use about 7 years ago. The length of stay in our emergency departments was about 8 to 9 hours. And the length of stay before we started this study was about 7 to 8 hours. So there was not much difference, maybe 1 hour lesser than previous chest pain study that we did at the same centers. We said, so the chest pain management remained the same, except maybe just a small reduction in ED length of stay. They are getting serial troponins, they are getting monitored, they are getting staying in the monitored bed. Hence, we don't believe the management has changed drastically within these 10 years. Hence, it is very appropriate, the results of the study, regardless of the time delay.
you sort of answered my next question there, Dr. Venk, because I was going to ask you about this possibility of a temporal bias, because you acknowledge the time lag, but you dismiss the possibility of having a temporal or time bias because the two studies were done in the same institution. But you've gone on further to explain it in your answer there, because I was going to mention that medicine has changed over the last 10 or 15 years, certainly in the 20 years that I've been out working up patients with chest pain. I've seen all these sort of changes in the cardiac markers back to, you know, CK and then CKMB and then troponins. And now we have these high sensitivity troponins looking at 1 and 2 hour deltas. But you don't think that these new high sensitivity troponins and this change in practice would impact your clinical decision tool here?
So we looked at whether we should incorporate troponins in the model. Then we said that by the time the troponin results come back, they're already at least like minimum of, I don't know about your emergency departments, like we have a physician assessment time roughly around 2 hours in our emergency department. So it takes about an hour for the troponins to come back. So we are at least 3 hours at the best of days. And at the worst of days, we are probably about 5 to 6 hours. If we monitor a patient for 6 hours and then we decide them that they do not need monitoring, they probably will be very less health resource reduction if we did that. The ideal thing will be to be this tool to be used before they are placed in monitors. If they are placed in monitors, it will also give you a leeway to take the patients off monitors. So hence, we purposefully did not include troponin because I think the decision can be done at triage as to who needs a monitoring and who does not need a monitoring. That's one. And second thing is that yes, there has been a lot of literature out there about the new troponins. Still, we do not have a clear-cut pattern for every study that says, like, you know, 2 hour troponin is good, or like the only one troponin is good. There is an equally another study that comes back and says, well, you would miss so many patients if you were to do this. And we have not adopted in practice many of these high sensitivity troponins. We do not use a high sensitivity troponin now in our center. We are using a contemporary troponin or medium sensitivity troponin. So we are still keeping patients at least for a delta troponin for about somewhere between 3 hours to 6 hours. So until practice changes, it might have an impact. But if we start applying this in triage, that if you don't have an active chest pain and your ECG looks fine, then we can take troponin completely out of the equation. And then what we are saying is that 1/3 of patients who would have actually been assigned to a monitoring area could now be assigned to a non-monitored area.
Well, I think we've covered issue number 4 about time and external validity. Let's move on to the 5th and final question that we had for you.
All right. So this question pertains to the future studies. Does your group have plans to externally validate the Ottawa chest pain cardiac monitoring rule in a different patient population?
Yes. So at the present time, we started, I'm just going to talk a little bit about implementation and as well as external validation. At the present time, locally, we started implementing it at the Ottawa hospitals. We started implementing it at the physician level and the nurses level after they have been assigned a monitored bed as to how many patients can be taken off of monitored beds. We have gotten into a little bit of barriers in the form of implementing it, because once they are assigned a monitored bed, there is a little bit of reluctance both at the physician and at the nursing level to take them off monitors. At the end of the shift, you have like 10 patients who are in a waiting room. Like, you know what? Like, you know, if you don't see them, it's not your problem. You really don't want to hand over, hey, I have 10 patients waiting to be seen in this area, and this is how I'm handing over to you. Looks worse than, you know what, there is no beds and we are not able to bring these 10 patients. They are in the waiting room. That looks actually better when you're handing over. But the nursing level, we also find that when they have these patients who are removed off monitors, still they are under their care. Now they have an increased workload of new patients and new workup of patients. So it has not been extremely successful. There has been only like, you know, 20% to 30% success rate in the implementation of eligible patients. Hence, we are moving to triage, and then we are going to have this implemented at the triage. If they don't have a chest pain that is elicited by the triage nurse, as part of our overall flow, we have an emergency physician look at the ECG always to identify STEMI so that they can be taken to the cath lab quickly rather than a delay. They're also going to identify whether the ECG is normal or does have only non-specific changes. If these two criteria are fulfilled, then the triage nurse can assign them to a non-monitored area. So that's what's happening locally. In the meantime, we also have Calgary, which is implementing this, and we are hopeful that other sites will implement it. And as part of the chest pain consortium, that we'll be able to collect data across Canada, and we'll also do the external validation at the same time as we are implementing this protocol.
And do you think in this external validation, you would include a comparison with a clinical gestalt element to the decision rule?
So because it is going to be a validation study, and if you actually validate it, you will have to have other centers who are not exposed to the rule in the form of a cluster randomized trial to be the control group where gestalt is going to be used. We could potentially use that, and it again depends on the funding, and again depends on what the chest pain consortium is able to come up with centers that we can do it. If not, we know that based upon our study in our center, that 71% of all patients are being monitored. It will not be too difficult to find out what is the percentage of patients who are assigned a monitored bed, because we do have good data on the prevalence of arrhythmias. It's 1-2%. So if more than 50% of all chest pain patients are being assigned a monitored bed across Canada, we know already we are just wasting a lot of resources of monitored bed space to these patients. While we can do this comparison in the form of cluster randomized trial to just look at clinical gestalt, we will already know if more than 50% of patients across Canada are being monitored, this is waste of resources. We really don't have to do that on. We just need to implement it. We'll have to look at the external validity of this as we are implementing it.
Well, Venk, those were the five nerdy questions we wanted to ask you. But we want to give you one other opportunity. Is there anything else you feel is important that the SGEMers know about this study?
Just wanted to say a little bit about the external validity. While the medical legal aspects of it may be different in different countries, for example, in the U.S., it may be really more medical legally prone than in Canada, the prevalence is low. And if you use the tool and if we externally validate it and if we have a narrow confidence interval, still, I think the benefits of healthcare resource savings will be highest in the United States than compared to other countries which use less amount of monitoring. In Canada, it's 1/3 of patients who can be taken off of monitors or not be assigned monitored beds. It will be quite higher in the United States. So if the rule performs well, it's a valid rule. If it identifies all patients with arrhythmias, it really does not matter what context or what the medical legal environment is. Still, it will perform fine and it will save a lot more money in the United States than here.
So what would you tell listeners out there? Would you tell them that this Ottawa chest pain cardiac monitoring rule is ready to be implemented now in their institution?
Yes, it can be. It is ready to be implemented. You can implement it. And if you are really leery about it, collect data at your center and see how well it performs. We believe that if you look at the two characteristics, even if the ECG being normal, then you have 100% sensitivity rate if the ECG is normal or only shows non-specific changes. We wanted to include the clinical characteristics in the form of ongoing chest pain. That could be anything else that is going on. Hence, we included that, which was there in the original study too. Plus, we also feel that you use a clinical decision tool only when you are in a bind, when you don't know what to do. If it is very clear that somebody has got unstable vital signs, they are not looking good, and it's not an arrhythmia that you're concerned about. You're concerned about their low blood pressure or they are not looking well. Those patients obviously need monitoring, and you don't need a clinical decision tool or a rule to tell you. but it is the low-risk chest pain patients who are looking really good, and the ECG is fine. You don't have any chest pain. They don't have ongoing chest pain. That's when you want to say, okay, can I take them off monitors? Yes, because the rule says they are at very low risk for chest pain. You can confidently take them off of monitors.
Well, thank you very much again for coming on and helping us understand this paper to a greater level.
Thanks, Ken, and thanks, Anthony.
Thanks, Dr. Vink.
All right, so it's time to comment on the author's conclusions and compare them to the SGEM's conclusions.
I think we generally agree with the author's conclusions.
And how about a bottom line? Can somebody give me a bottom line?
So some patients presenting with chest pain who are chest pain free and have normal and nonspecific EKG findings could potentially be safely removed from cardiac monitoring using this Ottawa chest pain and cardiac monitoring rule.
All right, how about a case resolution? You presented a case. How are you going to resolve the case?
So you remove the patient from cardiac monitoring. A second EKG and troponin are normal. You discharge him home as a low-risk patient with your local standard outpatient follow-up.
All right, now it's time to reflect and say, how are we going to take this new information and clinically apply it in our practice?
The Ottawa chest pain cardiac monitor rule can definitely help support physicians, particularly working in crowded emergency departments, helping them to allocate their scarce resources safely. However, the Ottawa cardiac monitor rule should not replace clinical judgment, much like any other decision rules, rather guide our care. It is also important to note that the rule should only be applied to patients that do not have risk factors for other urgent chest pain differentials, such as pulmonary embolism, aortic dissection, esophageal rupture, or pneumothorax.
All right, and so now we've talked about the literature. We've critically appraised the literature. How do you bring the literature to the bedside and talk English or French at the bedside so that the patient understands what we're doing?
Your workup for your chest pain is reassuring so far. You no longer need to be monitored now and will go back to the waiting area. Should you develop any chest pain, palpitations, shortness of breath, or feel otherwise unwell while waiting for your lab results, please notify the nurses immediately.
All right, and that sound reminds me that it's time for the Keener contest. And last week's winner was Alex Crows, an advanced care paramedic from Belleville, Ontario. I probably mispronounced his name because I generally do that. He knew that ASA is the name of the NSAID that can be obtained from the bark and leaves of the willow tree that has been used for over 2,000 years. Who's got the Keener question for this week?
I got one for you, Ken. This will be a good one for our audience. So what is the name of the imaginary equilateral triangle with the heart at its center? It's formed by the axis of the three bipolar limb leads.
Ooh, now audience, don't scream out the answer because I know you all know the answer. Well, there you go. An SGEM Journal Club Live. I want to thank you, Ryan, for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
And of course, thank you to you, Anthony, for coming on the show.
It was a pleasure to be with you.
And of course, thanks to McGill University and the Emergency Medicine Department for inviting me back to do another Journal Club. And I think it would only be appropriate to have the audience give the SGEM tagline. So on three. One, two, three.
Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you've heard of A Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.
Talk to everyone next week.
I always feel like